Hello, everyone. It is time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHeck. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for a mostly cloudy day today, with the winds from the west at 6 to 12 miles per hour, and also mostly cloudy tonight. Very windy tomorrow and cooler. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 72 degrees with a low of 46, mostly cloudy and mild, and on Thursday a little more wind and cooler with a high of 59 degrees. It was 68 in Harlan and 30 in Audubon on Tuesday, and across the country it was 99 in Zapata, Texas, and 4 at Gothic, Colorado. Now, turning over to the front page of today's Des Moines Register and our headlines. Is sports betting oversight too weak? Iowa leaves compliance largely to companies. A story, a heck of a story. Would Iowa and Henry A. Wallace have been a good president? Book casts doubt. And Reynolds says, absolutely not open to tweaking AEA law windfall. And to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb. Here you go, Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. A heck of a story. Would Iowa and Henry A. Wallace have been a good president? A book cast out. Drawing on what he says are previously undisclosed Soviet records, an award-winning historian asserts in a new book that Henry A. Wallace, an Iowan who was a heartbeat away from the presidency, was even closer with the Russians than previously depicted, at one point letting dictator Joseph Stalin edit one of his most important political speeches. Published in January, The World That Wasn't, Henry Wallace and the Fate of the American Century, is a biography of Wallace, as well as a hypothesis about how the world may have been different had the Des Moines area's politician, publisher, and agronomist, vice president from 1941 to 1945, succeeded President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Instead, Wallace, who lived from 1888 to 1965, was dumped from the ticket before Roosevelt won a fourth term, and Wallace's replacement, Harry Truman, ascended to the presidency when Roosevelt died in 1945. Author Ben Stile is a senior fellow, director of international economics, and official historian at the Council on Foreign Relations, a highly influential nonpartisan think tank. He won acclaim and major award for previous histories, particularly his The Marshall Plan, Dawn of the Cold War, published in 2019. The same perilous period, when the Soviets went from being a wartime ally to a nuclear-armed rival of the United States, is the core of Stiles' 600-page biography of a man he told the Des Moines Register is simply one of the most fascinating political figures of the 20th century. Wallace was born on his father's farm near Orient in Adair County. He grew up first in Ames, where his father was a student, then an agriculture professor at Iowa State Agricultural College, now Iowa State University. When Wallace was 8, the family moved to Des Moines, where his father, and eventually he too, joined his grandfather in editing Wallace's Farmer, a widely circulated magazine that promoted scientific farming. A budding scientist, who as a teen experimented with growing strains of corn on a family plot in the Drake neighborhood, Wallace graduated from Iowa State and later founded Pioneer Hybrid Corn Seed Company. The business, an early leader in developing and popularizing what became the dominant strains of field corn, is now part of Corteva Agriculture in Johnston. The Wallaces were staunch progressive Republicans, and Wallace's father served as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture in the Harding and Cooling administrations before dying in office. Wallace was a bitter foe of fellow Iowa Republican Herbert Hoover, who as Secretary of Commerce during the Harding and Coolidge presidencies feuded with his father over foreign policy. Hoover succeeded Coolidge, and when he sought a second presidential term, Wallace endorsed and campaigned for New York Democrat Roosevelt, and, like his father, became Agriculture Secretary. During the New Deal era, as farmers struggled through the Great Depression, Wallace worked to institute farm support policies that laid the foundation for modern U.S. agriculture. He served as vice president in Roosevelt's third term during the heart of World War II. The contention that Wallace was overly sympathetic to the Soviets, both as vice president and later as a Truman critic, is not new. Published in 2000, American Dreamer, A Life of Henry A. Wallace, by former U.S. Senator John Culver and former Des Moines Register reporter John Hyde, also explored the controversy which led to Wallace's unceremonious replacement with Truman at the 1944 Democratic National Convention. But Stiles' book is harsher to Wallace's legacy than Culver and Hyde's, which focuses more on his achievements as a New Deal architect. Utilizing documents from Russia and the FBI, Style, a senior fellow and director of international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, portrays Wallace as deeply naive about the Soviets and their post-war intentions. In an interview with the Register, Style said he wants readers of the book to contemplate this contrafactual of what might the world have been today, the world we live in, if things had gone a little bit differently in 1944, and particularly over 2 days in July at that convention. We could be living in a very, very different world today. Stiles said he became fascinated with Wallace after filmmaker Oliver Stone's 2012 documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, that, among other unconventional positions, held that the Cold War could have been avoided had Wallace ascended to the White House. Wallace believed that Russia wanted peace and that the U.S. should avoid escalating its nuclear weapons program after World War II. Style, who credits noted historian Svetlana Chervanaya for assembling thousands of pages of documents, notes, translations, and detailed commentary used as reference material for the book, said he found the Soviets took cynical advantage of Wallace's dovishness. When Wallace toured the Soviet Union, Style said, his escorts carefully steered him away from evidence of Stalin's brutality. And when Truman took a hard line against the Soviets as president, creating NATO to oppose them in Europe even before Russia developed its own nuclear weapons, Wallace criticized his policies and ran against him as the Progressive Party nominee in 1948. Style found that Wallace, working through intermediaries, had even allowed Stalin to edit a draft of his major speech of the campaign, in which he vehemently opposed the so-called Truman document doctrine of communist containment. I had lots of really phenomenal documentation from Russian archives, which indicated that the Soviets, certainly over the course of the 1940s, were simply using him, basically as a useful idiot, in order to undermine American foreign policy. But they were uninterested in his peace initiatives, except as ways to exploit them, he said. He concluded, at odds with Stone, that there would have been a Cold War, even with Wallace as president, but that its onset would have been delayed. It would have been started 3 years later, with the United States at a very significant disadvantage, Style said. He said Wallace himself admitted as much, citing a 1952 public letter entitled Where I Was Wrong, in which he wrote, "Before 1949, I thought Russia really wanted and needed peace. After 1949, I became more and more disgusted with the Soviet methods and finally became convinced that the Politburo wanted the Cold War continued indefinitely, even at the peril of accidentally provoking a hot war." But Wallace also wrote that he had risked his public career in the interest of promoting peace between the U.S. and Russia, and that he believed that had Roosevelt remained alive and in good health, history would have been different, and the two countries would not have been in an arms race. "What I wanted was peace, but not peace at the price of communist domination. I thought the Soviets had more sense than to do what they have been doing during the past few years," he wrote. Style's book is met with praise from reviewers, especially in conservative-leaning publications like the Wall Street Journal and the National Review. But it also has its critics, none perhaps more vehement than Wallace's grandson, David Wallace Douglas, 75, of Santa Fe, New Mexico. In a letter penned to the Wall Street Journal soon after the book was released, Douglas wrote, "The World That Wasn't would be better titled The Henry Wallace That Wasn't." In an email to the Register, Douglas wrote, "The book describes itself as a political biography, but it resembles instead a prosecutorial screed, vacuuming up negative facts and comments about Henry A. Wallace and skimming over his accomplishments in the cabinet and as vice president." While Wallace admits his grandfather often was viewed as pro-Soviet, he wrote that it was because Wallace had a genuine interest in forging a friendlier relationship with Russia and avoiding conflict, the kind of conflict that an escalating arms race created in the Cold War. There's no question that toward the later 1940s he was seen as pro-Soviet, but very rarely did even Wallace's adversaries charge him as being pro-communist, since Wallace had made it clear he didn't approve of communism and thought Marxism godless, likely to be eclipsed in economic competition with the U.S. In most of his public utterances, except for a period near the end of the Progressive Party run when he blamed the U.S. excessively for provoking Russia, he was even-handed in his criticism of both the U.S. and the USSR. That passed in those years for pro-Soviet, Douglas wrote. He said the communication his grandfather had with Stalin was distorted in Stiles' book. "I was not surprised that Stiles excoriated the indirect secret Wallace-Stalin communication, labeling it with a loaded word, given the Trump campaign, collusion. Stiles paints Wallace's actions as alternatingly sinister and comical," he wrote. Quote, "Seen through Stiles' distorted lens, Wallace's actions were motivated by an effort to disrupt the 1948 election, not because, as is evident from Wallace's oral history, and indeed his efforts throughout his life, Wallace felt that the world was poised on the brink of military confrontation with the Soviet Union." End quote. As for how history would have been written had his grandfather become president, Douglas wrote that Wallace would have been encouraged economic rather than military competition with the Soviets and opposed their expansionism, that he would have been far more effective in winning over the Third World because of his opposition to colonialism as antithetical to the values for which the Allies fought in World War II, and that he would have pushed far harder on behalf of such issues as civil liberties, equal pay for equal work, desegregation, and environmental sustainability. These policies, most now integrated into the fabric of American life, reflect favorably on Wallace's vision and are not surprisingly omitted from Stiles' post-1945 scenario, which is essentially limited to a binary focus on U.S.-USSR relations, Douglas wrote. Stiles agrees that Wallace showed considerable courage when he campaigned in the Deep South in 1948, advocating against segregation. In the 48 election, he spent a week touring the South, decrying racial segregation, which took enormous physical courage. He could easily have been killed many times during that tour, he said. Bill Pratt, a retired history professor from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, who has spent time studying Wallace's papers at the University of Iowa, said Stiles' book is well-researched. He does not question its objectivity. Pratt said his biggest criticism would be the amount of space Stiles devotes to Wallace's fascination with spiritualism. Quote, "He has a long chapter, maybe the longest chapter in the book, on this goofy stuff with spiritualism and so forth. Well, you don't forget about that, but boy, that's a lot of pages," Pratt said. Stiles said he wants readers to understand that despite his political failings, Wallace, named by the Register in 1999 as the most influential Iowan of the 20th century, was still an important figure in American history, and aims particularly to be remembered for his contributions to agricultural science. He's improved productivity of agriculture, not just in the United States, but certainly in Mexico and other parts of the world, and some of his developments, I've read, were apparently even very influential in India. If he had simply stayed an agricultural scientist and commentator, I think he would be much more positively recognized today across the political spectrum. As you know, he has his fans on the progressive left, but outside of that, he's just not," Stiles said. "Henry Wallace was an incredibly complex human being. He was a brilliant scientist. He was a credulous mystic, The way things combined to shape this remarkable political figure, who came within a hair's breadth of being leader of the free world, is really, really just remarkable. I think it's a heck of a story, he added. Pratt agreed about how compelling the Wallace story is, but said he thinks the length and depth of Stiles' work would likely be too intimidating for the average reader. It's for historians, political scientists, journalists, people that follow American foreign policy, like the Council on Foreign Relations and crowd. You're not going to see a paperback edition of this at the airport, he said.
Moving on to our next story in the Des Moines Register. Is sports betting oversight too weak? Iowa leaves compliance largely to companies. Second of two parts. Following the U.S. Supreme Court's 2018 decision that allowed every state to legalize sports betting, Iowa quickly welcomed the industry. The legislature passed a bill in 2019 that let casinos offer wagering on games. The bill also allowed casinos to contract with companies like FanDuel and DraftKings to offer online betting. The business boomed. The amount of money people in Iowa bet on sports increased from $368 million in fiscal year 2020 to $2.47 billion in fiscal year 2023, which ended last June. But some elected leaders involved with the bill now say the legislature needs to rework aspects of the law, especially in light of the recent controversial criminal cases against Iowa State University and University of Iowa athletes and student managers who bet on games. The state's legislation dictates that the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation will investigate sports betting crimes, just as the agency investigates casino gambling and horse racing. But the law does not lay out specific ways that agents can investigate bets. Instead, the law states that sports betting companies must monitor their own users and report problems to the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission. It's kind of the fox watching the hen house, said Tom Coates, director of Consumer Credit of Des Moines and a decades-long critic of the state's gambling industry. According to state law, company officials must tell the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission if they see indications of match fixing, money laundering, or someone using a fake identity to wager. The law also states that companies must try to prevent athletes, coaches, or other team members from placing bets on their own games. The law, along with the rules the commission adopted, does not specify the steps the companies must take to identify illegal activity. However, the law requires company officials to tell the commission about potential crimes they spot. The commission, in turn, can give the information to law enforcement agencies, a team, or a sports league. Sports books did not flag the Iowa and Iowa State athletes, who used betting apps registered to parents and friends, according to the DCI. Instead, state investigators used geolocation software provided by a company that works with the sports books to conduct their own investigation, which resulted in accusations that some athletes had placed wagers on their sports and on their own team's games based on subpoenaed records of the account histories. After critics claim that the DCI had violated the athletes' privacy rights by using the software without obtaining a warrant, the company, GeoComply, cut off the agency's access, and a prosecutor dropped charges in several cases involving Iowa State athletes. Internally, investigators and regulators have expressed doubts about the industry policing itself, according to emails that the Des Moines Register obtained through an open records request. In October of 2022, then-Gaming Commissioner Brian Orlico told DCI Assistant Director David Jobes in an email that Iowa bettors had placed 48.2 million sports wagers in 2021. Among those bets, Orlico said sportsbooks self-reported 17 as suspicious, about one out of every 2.8 million wagers in the state. Our staff is telling me this has been a struggle with the industry as there were some different expectations as to what is, quote, suspicious, Orlico said. It demonstrates on a basic level, a base level, that suspicious activity is significantly underreported, Jobes responded. State Senator Dan Dawson, Republican from Council Bluffs, who was on a subcommittee that helped write the 2019 bill and also is a DCI special agent, said he can't recall why the lawmakers chose to have the companies monitor their own activity. A former gambling investigator, he said online sports betting presents more challenges than gambling investigations at a casino. Legal online sports betting is a relatively new industry that regulators and law enforcement are still learning how to corral. But Iowa investigators also are far from most of the action at the center of the online betting. Checking poker tables and slot machines in one of Iowa's 19 casinos is easier for the DCI than monitoring fraud at basketball games in California. Iowa DCI agents are stationed at every casino in the state, where they have access to surveillance cameras and digital tracking systems that allow betting activity by individual gamblers. Bettors also must show identification when they arrive at the casinos, where employees use computerized verification programs to check whether their IDs are authentic. Regulators could also go into a brick-and-mortar building and say, quote, "Hey, show us your books," or "Show us your software," or "Let's weigh the dice," Dawson said. No equivalents exist in Iowa's online sports betting law. Edward Martin, a former New York gambling and horse racing regulator who formed the Sports Betting Regulators Association in 2022, said many states have written laws similar to those in Iowa. They did not put the state agencies in responsibility to conduct integrity investigations and monitoring, he said. They put that responsibility with the sportsbooks. Referring to the turmoil then ensued when the DCI tried to take a more active hand in enforcing the laws on college athletes, he added, what happened in Iowa has raised a red flag for pretty much everyone. Last month, after consulting with the Iowa Department of Public Safety, parent agency of the DCI, the Gaming Commission tried to amend sports betting regulations. The changes would have required companies to take extra steps to verify a user's identity. The companies would need to use multi-factor identification, sending a code to an account's registered email address or phone number that the users would then need to plug in on the app before using it. The companies also would have had to take extra steps to verify new users, comparing their selfie photos to government IDs or asking user-specific questions the company has received from a data service like LexisNexis, such as having them verify previous addresses. Asked during a March 11th Administrative Rules Review Committee about the origins of the proposals, Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission Administrator Tina Eek said the governor's office asked her agency and the Public Safety Department to come up with new anti-fraud rules following the headlines from last year, a reference to the sports betting scandal. Nate Risto, the Administrative Rules Coordinator for Governor Kim Reynolds, disputed that version of events. He said then Gaming Commission Director Orlinko proposed the idea for stricter rules to the governor's staff, which signed off on the plan. At any rate, the committee rejected the rules, likely postponing the proposed changes for at least a year. The lawmakers on the committee said one particular proposal, which would require betting companies to maintain or buy a list of sports team personnel, was too vague. State Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat from Des Moines, who was on a subcommittee that helped draft the 2019 bill, told the Register that lawmakers need to, quote, tighten the law down a little bit, end quote. He said lawmakers did not intend for industry to regulate itself. These are the kinds of things that we really didn't discuss in detail, he said. A lot of it may have been to naivety. Dawson said investigators will still need help from the sports betting industry to detect fraud and other crimes, regardless of what the law book says. Even with casino gambling cases, he said, investigators rely on tips from casino employees about where to look for fraud. With the current sports betting law, he added, there's obviously areas of improvement.
Reynolds is absolutely not open to tweaking the AEA law windfall. Governor Kim Reynolds says she's absolutely not open to tweaking Iowa's recently passed Area Education Agency overhaul to limit how school districts can spend the windfall of millions of dollars they'll be taking over from the agencies, rejecting concerns from some House Republicans. One of the law's provisions will give school districts about $68 million that the AEAs currently receive to provide general education services and media services. But districts will not have to spend the money on similar services and can use it for any school district general fund purpose, the law states. House Republicans have expressed concerns about that section of the law. The chamber originally passed a version of the legislation that would have required school districts to continue spending the money on education and media services. They just wouldn't have to receive those services from the AEAs. Representative Brent Sigrist, Republican of Council Bluffs, last week called the language in the final version of the law an oversight and said the plan is that we'll put some language in another bill to take it back to the original language. Asked by reporters Tuesday if she would be open to the solution that Sigrist suggested, Reynolds said, "No, I'm absolutely not. That was the deal." Reynolds said the law provides local control to school districts to use the money how they think is best. If they want to pass that money on and utilize the AEAs, the beauty of it is that they can, she said. It doesn't prevent that. But they know best what's important for the kids in their district. And so they're going to decide how to use that money, and that's how it should always be. Reynolds previously suggested school districts could use some of the new money to raise teacher salaries if they wanted to spend more than the state will be providing them to reach new minimum salaries of $50,000 for starting teachers. In the coming school year, districts will gain control over 60% of the money that AEAs currently receive for education and media services. School districts will receive 100% of the money beginning in the 2025-26 school year. That pool of money amounts to $35.7 million for general education services and $32.3 million for media services. AEA officials such as Cindy Yellick, chief administrator of the Heartland AEA in Central Iowa, say allowing school districts flexibility over how they use the money would likely result in less funding coming into the AEAs to provide education and media services. They could use that money in a lot of different ways, so it just means there's potentially less focus for those dollars on educational services, professional development, and media resources, Yellick said last week. The media services offered by the AEAs include online resources like ebooks, search engines, databases, and other technology. While the education services include professional development for teachers and school staff, mental health trainers, literacy coaches who can help teachers with new strategies for teaching reading, and more.
Turning over now to the Metro and Iowa section on our headlines. Mormons in Iowa have 70 congregations, but will soon have their first temple, the church announces. Court halts Art Center's plan to remove installation. Hearing set on possible preliminary injunction. From the State House, farmland ownership bill signed into law. And also from the State House, rules for 6-week abortion ban approved. Implementation is pending Supreme Court decision. I'll start with that article. Iowa lawmakers have paved the way for the state's rules on enforcing a 6-week abortion ban if the Supreme Court of Iowa allows it to go into effect. On Monday, the Iowa Legislature's Administrative Rules Review Committee allowed the framework for Iowa's abortion law, which bans the procedure when cardiac activity can be detected in the embryo, to move forward unchanged. These administrative rules were crafted and approved by the Iowa Board of Medicine earlier this year and serve as guidelines for how doctors can comply with the so-called fetal heartbeat law's narrow exceptions. The Legislative Rules Committee was the final hurdle for the Board of Medicine's rules. With lawmakers' approval this week, the rule will go into effect on April 24th. However, enforcement of the abortion ban's administrative rules ultimately will depend on the Supreme Court's decision later this year. On Thursday, the justices are scheduled to hear oral arguments on whether enforcement of the 6-week abortion should be allowed while a larger legal battle over the law plays out in the courts. A decision is expected by the end of June. The rules will take effect on April 24th, but the state and Board of Medicine will not be allowed to conduct any proceedings under the law or under the rules until the injunction from the trial court is reversed. Leif Olson, Chief Deputy Attorney General for the Iowa Department Attorney General's office, told this to lawmakers on Monday. While the new law remains tied up in the courts, abortion remains legal in Iowa up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. So where do things stand with Iowa's abortion law? The law, signed into effect by Governor Kim Reynolds in July, prohibits nearly all abortions after doctors detect cardiac activity in the embryo, which can occur about 6 weeks into the pregnancy. There are narrowly defined exceptions for rape, incest, fatal fetal abnormalities, and cases of medical emergency. Enforcement of the law was quickly blocked by a Polk County District Court judge while a legal challenge over the abortion ban plays out in the courts. Even with the injunction, language in the law directing the Iowa Board of Medicine to craft administrative rules for enforcement of the ban was still in effect, according to officials with the Iowa Attorney General's office. As Iowa's top medical entity, the board is the sole authority to enforce the law in the state. So what did lawmakers say about the abortion ban's administrative rules? There was little discussion among lawmakers on the specifics of the Board of Medicine's administrative rules on Monday. Senator Cindy Winkler, Democrat from Davenport, criticized them, stating she felt it was inappropriate the administrative rules had an effective date before the courts ruled on the abortion law. Because so much of this bill did not really include medical terminology when it was passed, I think that it is unfortunate that we have these rules in place and will be in effect before the court case is determined, Winkler said. She also raised concerns about the rule's definition of, quote, unborn child, as an individual organism of the species Homo sapiens from fertilization to live birth. Winkler said the language could have ramifications for in vitro fertilization care in Iowa, pointing to an Alabama Supreme Court case earlier this year that determined embryos created through IVF should be legally considered children. As a result, IVF care in Alabama was briefly halted. Existing Iowa code also uses the same language to define unborn child, prompting concern from IVF providers in Iowa that a similar impact could happen in the state. So what do the Board of Medicine rules say? The Board of Medicine rules dictate steps doctors must take to determine whether a patient qualifies for an abortion under the law's exceptions. That includes the requirement to conduct an ultrasound to determine whether cardiac activity can be detected in the embryo. Under the board's rules, doctors must gather certain information to determine whether the pregnancy was the result of incest or rape, but they do not dictate how physicians collect those details. If a patient is seeking an abortion in the cases of fetal abnormality, the rules state doctors must sign a certificate attesting to their support of fetal abnormality and a description of why the abnormality is incompatible with life. They must also document any tests or procedures used to determine that diagnosis. However, the rules fail to provide specific guidelines on how endangered a pregnant individual must be before a doctor is allowed to intervene in cases of medical emergency. Some doctors have said that without clear guidelines, medical providers may wait to intervene until their patient's health worsens in order to avoid discipline. The rules also do not provide any insight on the possible penalties that doctors violating the abortion ban may face from the Iowa Board of Medicine. The guidelines simply say failure to comply with the law or the administrative rules, quote, may constitute grounds for discipline. Under existing administrative rules, the board has the authority to revoke or suspend a physician's license or impose civil fines up to $10,000, among other disciplinary action. The Iowa Attorney General's office has stated in the past that the administrative rules would not provide a basis for doctors to face civil or criminal prosecution for violating the law.
Farmland Ownership Bill has signed into law. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a law with new disclosure requirements for foreign owners of Iowa farmland and steeper penalties if they fail to comply. Reynolds, a Republican, signed Senate File 2204 Tuesday morning at the Iowa State Capitol. The governor called for the proposal in January during her annual condition of the state address, and it sailed through the Iowa legislature in February with unanimous support. Reynolds and Iowa already had a strong law on foreign land ownership that was a model for the nation, and the new legislation makes it even stronger. "When Iowa speaks, the country listens," Reynolds said. "And with this bill, our message is unmistakable. American soil belongs in American hands." The law gives Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd the power to subpoena financial information, purchase agreements, and other documents while investigating possible violations of Iowa's foreign land ownership regulations. It also requires foreign landowners to provide details to the state about their holdings in other states that exceed 250 acres. The Iowa Secretary of State must submit an annual report of foreign land holdings to state leaders. The law boosts penalties for foreign owners who fail to register their land holdings or meet reporting requirements. Failing to register a purchase or holding will result in a fine of up to 25% of the property's value per violation. Previously, the law called for a fine of no more than $2,000 per violation. Failing to report holdings once every 2 years will result in a penalty of up to $10,000 per violation. "If you're a foreign landowner, we will know who you are," Senator Dan Zumbach, Republican of Ryan, said at the bill signing. "We will know where you are, we will know what you are up to, and we will know your intentions. And if you're planning on breaking Iowa's law, you will receive the wrath of A.G. Byrd." As of 2022, about 514,000 acres of Iowa farmland are held by foreign entities, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture data. That amounts to roughly 1.6% of the state's 32 million acres of crop, timber, and other agriculture land. The bulk of those holdings are long-term leases for wind, solar, and other renewable energy projects. China appears to be a minor owner of Iowa acreage, according to USDA data. Chinese-owned seed and crop protection company Syngenta owns 281 acres in Boone County. The largest foreign holder is Canada at close to 200,000 acres, followed by Italy at 104,400 acres. Around 181,300 acres are not specified because federal authorities not being able to identify nationalities. These landholders could be partners across several nations.
Court halts Art Center's plan to remove installation. The Des Moines Art Center was ordered to halt efforts to remove an outdoor art installation in Greenwood Park after the artist sued last week. U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa Judge Stephen Locker granted the temporary restraining order Monday. In his ruling, Locker said the Art Center hasn't proved the installation is an immediate safety issue, and it does not have the outright authority to remove it. Mary Miss, the New York-based artist responsible for the artwork entitled Greenwood Pond, Double Sight, alleged in her lawsuit last week that the Art Center's decision to remove her installation is a breach of contract and a violation of the Visual Arts Right Act of 1990. The installation, completed in 1996, includes a pavilion, walkways, and a trough. Demolition was set to begin this week. Art Center leaders informed Miss last year that the installation would be removed from the park, citing a public safety risk. Leaders also said the cost of repairs and long-term maintenance would surpass the Art Center's $7.7 million annual budget. Quote, "I am pleased and relieved by Judge Locker's decision, but only for what it has done for Greenwood Pond Double Sight, because it reaffirms the rights of all artists and the integrity of their legacies," Miss said in a news release provided by nonprofit the Cultural Landscape Foundation. "Let's use this opportunity to reach an outcome of which we can all be proud." A preliminary injunction hearing will occur within 14 days to determine what's next for the temporary restraining order. The Art Center said in a statement Monday that its responsibility to public safety is paramount, and we believe we are compelled to take action as required per our 1990 agreement with the City of Des Moines to correct what has become a hazardous environment. A structural review last year prompted the Art Center to close portions of the installation off to public access. Those closures occurred in October of 2023, and several elements of Greenwood Pond Double Sight were removed. The Art Center said it will pause plans to remove Greenwood Pond double site, plans that included enclosing the pond and a section of the paved trail with fencing, draining the pond, and disassembling and removing the elements that comprise the artwork. The Art Center stated sections declared, quote, dangerous and unsalvageable, will remain enclosed in protective fencing. In his ruling, Locker agreed that the Art Center has the authority to determine, after consultation with a professional conservator, when and if repairs and restorations to the project will be made, per its agreement with MIS, and that it may mean MIS can't force the Art Center to make repairs and restorations for Greenwood Pond double site. The court disagreed that it gives the Art Center the unilateral authority to remove the artwork. In reference to its agreement with the city, Des Moines officials may require the Art Center to remove the installation if the Art Center has failed to either maintain the structural integrity of a sculpture or to correct any unsafe condition within a sculpture. But Locker said if the city required this, it would supersede MIS's agreement with the Art Center. And the court found that there is nothing in the record to suggest that the city has ordered, directed, or otherwise required the Art Center to remove the artwork. Des Moines Parks and Recreation Director Ben Page said in a statement to the Register in January that said the city has not demanded the removal, but does intend to assist the Des Moines Arts Center where applicable to help ensure the safety of park patrons. Locker also wrote that while the Art Center argues Greenwood Pond double site is an active public safety hazard, the record to support that is mixed. He pointed to a condition report from July of 2022 that stated the artwork is in fair condition overall, with some elements in poor condition due to the structural instability, and that it didn't appear to suggest demolition or limiting public access. The court said in a more recent condition report paints a slightly more pessimistic picture, yet led to fencing and the removal of some elements of the installation, and ultimately closing off access to a small portion of the installation. The rest is still fully open to the public with, at most, simply a missing or warped piece of wood here or there, Locker wrote. In these circumstances, and solely for the purpose of determining whether to issue a temporary restraining order, the record does not reflect an imminent safety issue resulting from the presence of the artwork.
Mormons in Iowa have 70 congregations, but will soon have their first temple, the church announces. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, widely known as the Mormon Church, announced Sunday that it will plan to build 15 temples across the globe, including one in Des Moines. While Iowa has 70 Latter-day congregations, this will be the first temple in the state. Churches are places of everyday worship, while temples are the house of the Lord and the most sacred place of worship on the earth, according to a news release from the organization. Iowans currently have to drive 2 to 4 hours to reach the nearest temple, said Susan Sims, Communications Director of the Iowa and Western Illinois region of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Church members here in Iowa have long wanted a temple, Sims said. We have long prayed to have a temple here. In his announcement Sunday, Russell Nelson, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, said the church is doing all within our power to make a temple more accessible to members. His announcement concluded the organization's April 2024 General Conference. The announcement did not describe a location for the temple other than Des Moines. Sims said they don't yet have a location picked out. Polk County records show the church bought 19.6 acres of land near the intersection of Northwest 62nd Avenue and Northwest 86th Street in Johnston. The sale closed in October for $2.5 million. According to the church, Iowa is home to more than 29,000 active Latter-day Saints in about 70 congregations. The temple will be a place only for members of the church who are in good standing are allowed to enter the temples, according to its website. Iowa has a long history with the Latter-day Saints. Nearly 200 people settled the southern Iowa town of Garden Grove, which served as a way station on the 1,300-mile route Mormons used to flee Nauvoo, Illinois, to the Great Salt Lake Valley in 1846, according to the National Park Service. Garden Grove, with its cabins and crops, served as a resting place for those who could not continue and for those who would soon arrive, and was active until 1852, the Park Service said. The Latter-day Saints announcement did not include information on what the Iowa Temple would look like. According to Sims, there are no current plans for the temple, and a timeline for construction has not been set. We don't know what it's going to look like, she said. We might not have the land, but this is our plan. But Iowa is one of the last of the Midwestern states to have a temple of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. And if it looks anything like those in Nebraska, Missouri, or Minnesota, it will be grandiose and likely made of white granite. Its 189 temples worldwide typically have spires or towers and a statue of the angel Moroni, a Book of Mormon prophet. Another 52 temples are under construction and 109 are planned. Where else are Mormon temples announced? The Latter-day Saints' other planned temples announced Sunday include Lutera in French Polynesia, Chihuahua, Mexico, Florianopolis, Brazil, Rosario, Argentina, Edinburgh, Scotland, Brisbane, Australia, Victoria, British Columbia, Yuma, Arizona, Houston, Texas, Cincinnati, Ohio, Honolulu, Hawaii, West Jordan, Utah, Lehi, Utah, and Maracaibo, Venezuela.
In other Iowa news, Iowa man wanted by FBI arrested on charges of wire fraud and money laundering. The FBI has found a Waukee man who was included on its most wanted list for charges of wire fraud and money laundering. It and the Iowa Department of Insurance and Financial Services Fraud Bureau had been looking for William Jack Berg, age 51, of Waukee, since late March. Berg was found and arrested Thursday in Shawnee, Kansas. According to the FBI's website, Berg is a financial advisor who allegedly defrauded more than a dozen clients in a scheme that cost them more than $1.5 million, using the money for his personal benefit. He was arrested without incident by the Shawnee, Kansas Police Department. Amy Adams of the FBI office in Omaha said in a statement to the Des Moines Register he has made an initial appearance in federal court. From Cedar Rapids, Cedar Rapids police identify a man fatally shot by officers. The Iowa Department of Public Safety has identified the man killed by the Cedar Rapids police on Saturday as 40-year-old David Vanderham of Cedar Rapids. The department said in a news release that the shooting occurred after police received a 911 call about 6:30 p.m. Saturday from the man asking them to send an officer to his residence. They then received a call from a second person who asked officers to make a welfare check on the man, who, the release said, was reported to have a gun and to be making homicidal and suicidal statements. According to Saturday's release, Vanderham allegedly raised his weapon at the officers upon arrival. Three of the responding officers fired at him, and he fell to the ground, dying at the scene. A bystander also was shot and was taken to the hospital. He also has been identified by the Department of Public Safety and said his name and information will not be released at this time, according to the release. The involved Cedar Rapids officers are on critical incident leave pending the completion of the investigation. The names of the officers will be released at a later time, and no other information has been released. This is the second fatal shooting by Cedar Rapids police this year. Also, an Iowa man pleads guilty to 2016 homicide and is sentenced to 10 years. The man who was arrested and charged in the mysterious death of 51-year-old Donald E. Preston in 2016 has pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Preston's body was found in Webster City soybean field on December 26th of 2016. His death had been unsolved for more than 6 years until 2023, when Christopher Todd Johnson, age 50, of Cedar Rapids, was arrested and charged with voluntary manslaughter. Johnson previously served 5 years in federal prison in connection with a guilty plea to a felony charge of being a felon in possession of a firearm. He was charged with Preston's death upon his release in February of 2023. According to court documents, Johnson pleaded guilty on January 26. He faces up to 10 years in prison and also will owe $150,000 to the victim's estate. And finally, another short story, police identify motorcycle crash victim. Des Moines police identify the motorcyclist killed in a crash Sunday as 41-year-old Des Moines resident Mitchell Holen. Police say Holen was riding east at 2:07 p.m. when he struck the passenger side of a Jeep driven by a woman, age 61, who was turning left from the westbound university onto southbound East 16th Street. Despite wearing a helmet, Olin was critically injured and died as Des Moines Fire Department medics were transporting him to a hospital, according to a news release. It said potential contributing factors to the accident include failure to yield and excessive speed. Police did not release any more information on the crash Tuesday. It was the fourth traffic-related fatality of 2024 and the third involving a motorcycle.
Most food stores no longer accept empty bottles and cans. 2 years after Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law major changes in Iowa's bottle and can redemption program, a nonprofit says Iowans have far fewer options for where they can redeem the beverage containers for a 5-cent deposit. The program, known as the Bottle Bill, allows Iowans to return empty cans and bottles to redemption centers, grocery stores, and convenience stores to get back a 5-cent deposit they paid when buying the drink. The changes Reynolds signed in June 2022 allow most grocery stores and convenience stores in the state to opt out of accepting empty containers if they either sell prepared food or are within 10 or 15 miles of a redemption center. Clear Iowa, a nonprofit that advocates for strengthening the bottle bill, said Monday at a news conference at the Iowa Capitol that the vast majority of grocery stores and convenience stores in the state have stopped accepting empty containers. The organization surveyed about 2,000 grocery stores, convenience stores, and other retailers and found that only 8.7% of the businesses that were allowed to opt out of the law are still accepting containers, while more than 91% no longer allow returns. Of those businesses, Cleaner Iowa found only 18.4% of grocery stores surveyed still allow Iowans to return bottles and cans to collect their deposit. That amounts to 89 of the 485 grocery stores the group contacted. Even fewer convenience stores, 5.5%, or 82 of the 1,479 stores contacted, still allow Iowans to return bottles and cans, the group found. Quote, this extremely low retailer participation rate makes it significantly more difficult for consumers to redeem their cans and could lead to recycling issues, said R.G. Schwann, Cleaner Iowa's executive director. If redemption is no longer convenient for consumers, redemption rates will fall. Cleaner Iowa also contacted 143 retailers that are still required by law to accept empty bottles and cans and found that only 8 allow Iowans to return the containers. The 2022 law tripled the 1-cent handling fee received by redemption centers for each container to 3 cents as a financial incentive to help the struggling businesses and spur more to open. Those fees are paid by beverage distributors. The number of redemption centers in Iowa has increased since the law was passed, from 60 in 2022 to 103 this year, according to Cleaner Iowa. But 29 of the state's 99 counties have no redemption centers, requiring Iowans to drive further if they want to claim their nickel deposit. Supporters of the 2022 law also touted the possibility that retailers could contract with mobile redemption centers as an option for Iowans to return empty containers. But the Iowa Department of Natural Resources website shows only 8 approved mobile redemption centers in use around the state. If no one returns the container to collect the deposit, the beverage distributor keeps the nickel. The law added civil penalties for violating the law and allowed the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to issue orders forcing violators to comply. But Schwarm said the DNR has not pursued enforcement because the system is driven by complaints and few Iowans know who to contact about enforcement. The 2022 law requires Iowa lawmakers to review the bottle bill changes before the 2026 legislative session. Cleaner Iowa is urging lawmakers to take a comprehensive look at the law during their review. Schwarm said the group supports changes that would increase the number of retailers participating in the program, expand the type of bottles and cans that are eligible for redemption, improve redemption center infrastructure, and educate the public on the law's enforcement mechanisms for businesses that aren't complying. Representative Brian Losey, Republican of Bondurant, shepherded the 2022 legislative session through the Iowa House. He said if the law isn't working, lawmakers should consider getting rid of it. I think if it's not going to work, what is the next step, he said. I don't know. I think one of the options on the table has to be just repeal it. He said he doesn't believe the solution is to require grocery stores and convenience stores to redeem empty containers again. They shouldn't have those dirty cans and bottles coming into places where they're preparing food, he said. So the reasons we let them opt out are still there.
Iowa says Clark changed women's sports forever, Reynolds says. Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday the University of Iowa women's basketball team has changed women's sports forever with the enthusiasm they generated in their NCAA tournament title-chasing season. The Hawkeye team, led by all-time leading college basketball scorer Caitlin Clark, fell short in the NCAA championship to South Carolina on Sunday. But it was the second straight year that the team played in the national championship game. And throughout the season, Clark broke record after record. The team also broke viewership records, with Sunday's championship game reaching an audience of 18.7 million people. It's been an incredible season with incredible talent and players, Reynolds told reporters Tuesday at the Iowa Capitol. And that team has changed women's sports forever. Reynolds pointed to the packed stadiums and record viewership of games, as well as the inspiration that the team and Clark had been for young girls. They really have just captured the hearts of the country, and they've done amazing things for women's sports, she said. And all you have to do is look at the little girls that are standing, not only in the audience with the signs, but are waiting to have a chance to shake her hand and have her sign something or to emulate what she's done. Asked if Coach Lisa Bluder's salary is high enough, Reynolds said she should be recognized for her achievements. She's done a great job, Reynolds said, and I think that should be reflected in the salaries. I want to always encourage recognizing excellence. And related, Iowa women's season to be celebrated Wednesday at Carver Hawkeye Arena. The University of Iowa is hosting a women's basketball end-of-season celebration on Wednesday, on April 10th, at the Carver Hawkeye Arena. The ceremony will start at 6 p.m. in honor of the NCAA runner-up. The Caitlin Clark-led Hawkeyes lost to South Carolina 87-75 in the NCAA title game on Sunday, April 7th in Cleveland. Head coach Lisa Bluder and former Iowa basketball player Dr. P. Sue Beckwith will speak during Wednesday's ceremony, as will Clark. The trio will be joined by fellow seniors Molly Davis, Sharon Goodman, Kate Martin, and Gabby Marshall. The Hawkeyes' various trophies will be on display throughout the evening. The celebration will be accompanied by the Iowa Spirit Squad, Herky, and the Iowa Pep Band. Free parking will be available in the lots surrounding Carver Hawkeye Arena starting at 4:30 p.m. Parking for those with disabilities, as available, will be located in Lot 40. Iowa earned the program's second number one seed in 2024 thanks to its Big Ten tournament title. The Hawkeyes also secured their second consecutive trip to the Final Four and the national title game. Iowa finished with a school record 34 wins, which is tied for the most ever by a Big Ten team. The UI Athletics Department requests that fans do not for the team's arrival before, let's see, the UI Athletics Department requests that fans do not for the team's arrival Monday afternoon. Missing some words there, but that's what it says. And just one little other piece of Iowa note. Governor Kim Reynolds and other state leaders attended a groundbreaking ceremony last week at the Iowa State University. A dual ceremony was held to dedicate and break ground for the $141 million Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory.